Testing. Testing.
See, I'm gonna go ahead and, Jim, our other board member, he's in, him and I are the active firefighters on the board, and he's on duty this morning. I just got relieved. I'll be there in a few minutes, so he's on duty this morning, so they have to find relief, then you move this one from the section to that rescue to, anyways, he's on his way, so we'll go ahead and get started without him, he should be here any minute. So, okay, you guys report off? Okay, it is, 9:04 a.m. on Monday, November 13th, 2017, calling to order the quarterly meeting of the Ocala Firefighters Pension Plan. And because we have someone from out of town who probably has to get back to the airport and all of that other stuff before we do anything on the agenda, we're going to start with the, presentation from Crescent Direct Lending. So, that being said, the floor is yours.
Great. All right, great. Well, thank you, very much for inviting us here to present our direct lending strategy to you today. As we kind of discussed earlier, as far as interest is, John Signetti, he's one of the managing director with Crescent, and one of the senior members of our direct lending team in Boston. My name is Pete Mitchell. I'm with the investor relations team, and I'm based up in the right outside the Jacksonville, Florida area, so not too far away. You know, again, this is your meeting, so, you know, please interrupt us with questions, you know, if you have them, you know, during the presentation. And what I'll do is I'll give you a quick background of Crescent and our firm as a whole. And then turn it over to John, and he'll kind of walk you through the direct lending space and the asset class, and then a little bit more on that in regards to our strategy and how we kind of run it. We're on a second direct lending fund, so that's what we're going to be talking about today. We'll mention direct lending fund one often to give you an idea of sort of how that strategy has performed and is coming to an end here soon. So I'll start on slide five. Turn to page five. Give you a little bit about our platform. So Crescent has been around since 1991. We're headquartered in Los Angeles. We have an office in Boston. We have an office in New York City and an office in London. So we have investment professionals around the world. We manage approximately about $24 billion in assets right now. About three of those in the book here in the pie chart, it says direct lending at 2.2, but we've had a first close on fund two of just over $700 million. So we're about $3 billion in assets right now in our direct lending strategy. And as you see on the two pie charts, we have what we call our private credit, which is direct lending. We have a mezzanine fund. And then on our public side, which is kind of high yield bank loans, so more tradable securities, where the private credit is not liquid as the tradable securities. But I think the important thing to take away here is of all our strategies, all we do is below investment grade corporate credit. And that's kind of what we've done since 1991. That's kind of all you'll see us do. We feel like that we have an expertise in that area. And we try and take advantage of that with people like John and some of our other investment professionals. And at the bottom, we see we're basically an institutional manager. 96% of our clients are institutional. People like yourself, pension plans, Taft Hartley plans, corporate plans, and things of that nature. If you turn to page six, just another page about our platform. Like I mentioned, we have offices around the world. We have about 160 employees. Flip to slide seven, that kind of talks a little bit more about the employees. So we have about 160 employees, about 80 of them on the investment side, which we think is obviously very important. It's kind of where the nuts and bolts of the firm are, is our investment people. And along with that, we know we have to have great back office and support people on the IR team, compliance, and sort of that. So we've been building the firm, I think, in a really prudent way, both on the investment team and on the operations team. So with that, if there's any questions about the firm in general, I can go to John and give it to the smart guy and tell you a little bit more about the Crescent Direct Lending strategy.
Thanks, Pete. So maybe flipping to page nine, this kind of encapsulates everything that we do. but focus on the investment strategy and jump in if you have questions along the way. We are providing, the direct lending team is providing senior secured loans to private equity-owned lower middle market businesses. So let me break that down in terms of what that means. So a senior secured loan is one that is collateralized by the underlying assets as well as the stock, not public stock like you see in a public market, but the, basically the equity ownership of the company. So all the collateral and assets of that company basically support our loans. So think about when you get a home mortgage, right? The bank provides you a loan on your house. That loan is collateralized by your home, right? So no different than what we're doing as a senior secured lender. So we're providing senior secured loans to private equity owned businesses. What is private equity? Private equity are groups of investors out there that typically have funds anywhere between 200 million and call it 2 billion in terms of what we target, who are buying companies, usually second, third generation, family owned businesses that want to quit for a variety of reasons. Maybe they don't have a son or a daughter to pass along the business to. Maybe they just want to liquidate and do something else. So these private equity companies go in and buy the businesses and usually invest, say it was a $100 million purchase price, usually invest 50% or more of their own equity in those businesses, and then we provide the balance to that purchase price in the form of debt. So we're supporting private equity owned lower middle market companies, and we think it's important that there's a private equity sponsor involved with these lower middle market companies, because one, the private equity firms usually bring an area of operational expertise to the businesses. Usually they're very niche focused, whether it's manufacturing business or a healthcare business, they usually have backgrounds in those areas, so those are the types of companies that they're buying. And then two, they have a lot of money, a lot of skin in the game, and they're buying these businesses. So if things go badly, there's additional checkbook, right, to invest capital into the company and to help see a situation through. And then finally, lower middle market. I mentioned lower middle market. What does that mean? We define the lower middle market as companies that generate between $5 billion and $25 million of EBITDA. EBITDA is a common term that we use in the industry, but as you think about it from a revenue perspective, typically companies that generate less than $100 million of revenue. Again, you ask, oh, those are pretty small businesses. Why are you investing in that space? We're investing in that space because, one, it's less competitive. So we're able to, by being less competitive, we're able to get really two primary benefits of that. One, we can get higher yielding loan. So our loans are typically 7-8% coupons, which are pretty high rates, right? And we're able to charge that amount for our loans because it's a less competitive environment. And two, we think we like to play in that space because we have very tight structures. You'll hear in the broader market, that there's covenant-lite structures. All of our underlying loans have covenant package such that if the business doesn't go according to plan, we have guideposts, we have kind of warning systems, warning flags that kind of pop, and it allows us to get out in front of problems before they become big problems, right? And I'll give you some examples of that. We have a leverage test in all of our underlying loans. We have a fixed charge coverage test. These are just metrics that allow us to kind of, mentally keep the company within a certain parameter, again, just to make sure that if something goes awry, we get out in front of it. We also have capital expenditure tests. So all of these mechanisms help us track our underlying portfolio companies pretty tightly.
Do you have independent auditors, or do you use their auditors?
Yes, so that's actually a good point. So on all of our investments that we're underwriting to, as part of our due diligence process, we review the company's historical financial statements. The vast majority of the time, they're audited by a third-party accounting group. We also get a quality of earnings report on every single transaction, which is another third-party group, which is not
someone that they've used in the past to review the income statement, the balance sheet, the cash flow statement, and really kind of dig in. It's usually done by the private equity firm buying the business, because they certainly don't want to buy a company off a value that's not really there, right? So it's often a little bit of a negotiating technique by the private equity firm if they find something that would suggest that the business maybe not doesn't generate, I don't know, 10 million of EBITDA, really generates 8, which allows them to change their value accordingly. So we look at that in every single transaction. So in addition to the companies having audited financial statements, we do third-party work by another accounting firm, and then internally within Crescent, we have our own auditors who review our portfolio and how we're valuing our loans on our balance sheet. That's a little bit different than really getting into the nitty-gritty of each company's financials, but we do have our own auditors as well. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay.
Then on an ongoing basis, once the company is in the portfolio, we do have accountants that mark the loans on a quarterly basis.
That's right. That's from a valuation standpoint. So they're looking at our portfolio and saying, well, this company isn't performing all that well. Maybe we shouldn't value it at 100 cents on the dollar. Fortunately, we don't have a lot of those, but we have that check and balance to make sure that we're giving visibility to our investors on how our portfolio is performing.
And I think it's important to know too that these companies that we're investing in, when we're investing in them, they're performing good, solid companies. We're not investing in distressed companies.
Yeah. Maybe I should take a couple seconds and just kind of give you an overview of the types of businesses we invest in. So companies we're investing in have been around for a long period of time. These aren't companies that, have only been in business 3 to 5 years. They typically have, long tenured management teams. They're typically in business models that have existed for a while, so they're not evolving business models. And we always look at the historical financial summary of businesses as a good indicator as to how the company will perform on a go-forward basis, right? We want to make sure that our underlying loan, the principal and interest that we're charging this borrower, that this company is able to support that principal and interest, right? So the nice part about having the 08-09 recession, maybe the only nice part about it, was that we actually have a rearview mirror, per se, as to how bad some of these companies performed. And so when we're sensitizing the businesses, as we're looking to put a loan on top of the business, where we are really taking that into account. So how poorly could the company perform and it still service our principal and interest, right? But back to Pete's point, these businesses are clean companies, they're performing companies, they're just typically smaller, right?
So why would they go to you and pay 7 or 8% interest instead of the Wells Fargo's or the Merrill Lynch's and pay 4%?
Sure. So there's a couple reasons for that. One, there's actually not that we had spent too much time on it, but there's a good chart on page 17. Which kind of shows you kind of the middle market loan volume and where banks are in today's market. Right? And I think that's first and foremost, the banks have really pulled out of corporate lending in the lower middle market space. A lot of that has to do with regulation. And a lot of that, candidly, a lot of the banks have kind of gobbled each other up. And because of that, they have higher hurdle rates, right, for their underlying borrowers, right? They have to cross-reference business internally to make that loan make sense, right? So they're not as focused on our market. So that's one reason. I think the second reason is, we've been doing this, I was going to get to this next. We've been in the market lending to private equity-backed companies since 2005. Our first fund, our predecessor fund, before we became part of Crescent, the team that I'm involved with, that I helped start this group, in 2005, we were called High Point Capital. And because we've been around since 2005, we've been able to establish these long-term relationships, not just with the underlying companies, but with the private equity firms that are buying these companies. And so the referral sources, the repeat referral sources that we have on businesses is really important. One, because they trust us. They know how we'll behave in good times and in bad. And finally, they want to get their deals executed, not just their original acquisition, but all their add-on acquisitions, and they know that we have the balance sheet and the mindset to do that. They don't, private equity firms don't make their returns based on 50 or 100 basis points of coupon spread from their lenders. That doesn't really even move the dial for their overall return. The way the private equity firm makes money at this company is really through growth of the business. And so they can, what they want to find is a partner, a lender, a non-bank lender that will support their growth, right? Banks typically lend money out, they want it back pretty darn quickly. We want our money back too, but as long as everything's going okay, and we've got all the right metrics in place, and we feel like we're in a conservative part of the capital structure, again, senior secured, backed by the underlying collateral and stock of the business, we're okay supporting growth, right? If they want to open up a new facility, we'd like to do that with you. We'd like to loan you more money to do that. So again, so long as everything, you know, measures up. So private equity firms make money, make their return by growing their businesses. We're better suited to help them grow their businesses. So that, and that's why. And because we've been around since 2005, and we're one of the few lenders in this space that have been around for that long, candidly, there's an established relationship and rapport that's been built over time, such that we always get the call on deals. They just want to execute their deals. They're not so focused on getting the lowest cost of capital, which is nice. So that gets us to our competitive advantages, and we've talked about, you know, a lot of this, but, you know, we've been around for a long time, by way of comparison to a lot of lenders out there since 2005. Why is that important? We've invested through cycles, right? So we know how to underwrite, and we've always been very conservative in our underwriting standards, but certainly having lived through the last recession, I think we've got a good sense as to what could happen, right? And so we're looking at companies today and always thinking back to, you know, what we experienced back in the recession, which, you know, is, I think, is important to highlight. In the worst recession during our lifetime, our experience as direct lenders, we took 17 companies, we had 17 loans at that time through the recession. We had no payment defaults in our 17 loans. We had 100% positive IRRs on all 17 portfolio companies that we brought through the recession. So there's not many other lenders in our asset class that can say that. And that's why we've been able to raise successive funds, because we have these established relationships. And we've been very conservative in terms of how we've underwritten businesses historically, which ultimately led to a very good track record, you know, investing through the recession. So that kind of hits the last point on the competitive advantages. We think we have one of the lowest credit loss experiences or histories of all the kind of direct lenders out in the market.
Just a quick perspective question.
Yeah.
And we've kind of had these preliminary discussions, obviously before Ricky got in, but one of the things that we tried to do at AMCO was to, you know, we identified a huge opportunity, as you did as well, coming out of the recession, since lending had dried up. It was a great opportunity, and at that time you were able to command actually much higher rates of, you know, lending rates, because the market had dried up.
Yeah.
There's been a lot of compression now.
Yeah.
And things have normalized. Can you give us an update to help us maybe manage expectations going forward of, you know, what kind of returns we should be realistically expecting? Because, you know, a lot of capital has gone your way and,
yeah,
and to your competitors.
Sure.
Making the space, you know, much more competitive than it was before.
Yeah.
Can you give us kind of a perspective on?
Yeah, sure. So the group here is looking at the levered fund, right? In terms of where you invest. We've targeted net returns in the levered fund of 10 to 12%. If you looked at our current fund, our current levered fund, we're just a shade under that. I think we're tracking at 9.5% on our leverage fund. I think with a rising interest rate,
which is going to happen. It is happening. You know, we'll get in that range quicker.
But again, I don't mean to pop too many things out here, but these are other items that we discussed.
Yeah.
And the IRR would go up because most of your loans are LIBOR based, right?
Yes. So yeah. That's good. So 100% of our loans are floating. 100% of our loans are based off of LIBOR. So any increase in LIBOR increases our coupon, right? So our typical loans on the senior side are, you know, LIBOR plus 550 to 600, call it. So that would equate today to 6.75 to 7.25 coupon. But as LIBOR rates increase, I mean, LIBOR a year ago was probably 50 basis points. So as LIBOR had gone from 50 basis points to over 1%, our coupons have increased. So we get the benefit of that. You get the benefit of that from a return perspective. And that's why, partially why this is an attractive investment, is because it's floating.
Have they fixed the LIBOR issue of the hacky-packy that was going on over there?
Yeah. So it's interesting. There's been talk of LIBOR going away completely as a metric to base loans off of. You know, we spend a lot of time with our attorneys on that in terms of when we document our underlying loan agreements. If it is, it will still be floating. It'll just be off of a different rate, right? It'll be based off of prime or something like that. But I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon, because the amount of, I mean, there's billions, trillions of loans that are tied to LIBOR. It would take a lot to unravel.
Yeah, and excuse my education for me, but LIBOR is based in London.
Yeah.
All your companies are based here in the United States, right? Mm-hmm. I would have thought that LIBOR was more
international. No, it's a good question. So all bank loans or lending loans are based off of LIBOR. It's just a common benchmark used by the industry. If you went to Bank of America or SunTrust Bank, they use LIBOR. They usually give you a LIBOR option and a prime option. It's just, for whatever reason, the industry standard.
Okay.
But yeah, it is kind of high. You're right. So look, from a return to hit the nail on the head, though, there are other competitors in the market, because I think, you know, while we were maybe pioneers or one of the first anyway to lend in this space, we've benefited from banks kind of exiting. I think, you know, word kind of catches on, you know, as other folks start to enter the space because they see the opportunity. But I think from our perspective, we've been able to hold on to our coupons. Maybe it's gotten a little bit tighter, but I think for the most part, we've been able to hold on to our coupons, really just because of our relationships, and getting back to the point about the private equity firms really, really valuing certainty as opposed to minimizing the coupon. That said, it does exist, but we do think that any compression in terms of spreads will be offset by a rising interest rate environment. I hope that answers the question.
Maybe too, on the fees, how the fees working into the, when you're underwriting the loan, how they work into the return as well.
Sure. So, So with every loan that we make, in addition to the coupon, right, the 7% or whatever we're charging in the bar, we're also charging a fee up front, which is, you know, some folks refer to in the industry as OID, original issue discount spread. Other folks refer to an upfront fee. We'll call it upfront fee. It's easier. That 1% to 3% is of the underlying loan. So, you know, I'm making a $10 million loan. I might get 1% on that $10 million upfront. And that fee comes to us, it goes to you, it helps your return. So we have that on all of our loans. We have an upfront fee, which I think is very helpful. And then on top of that, we have a prepayment penalty on the back end, right? Because, look, let's face it, you brought it up first. You know, you're charging 70%. At some point, the underlying borrower is like, all right, you know, at some point, we're going to grow to a point where we make sense for a bank, right? He might only need 10 million EBITDA today, but if we do a great job helping the private equity company grow that business to 200 million of revenue, right? Now, all of a sudden, the bank's like, oh, this is big enough, it makes sense. Let's refinance these guys out, right? So we have mechanisms on the back end such that we get paid so that we're not, so that we don't have a revolving door on our loans, right? Because it's hard to build up a loan portfolio if you get refinanced out every 12 months. So we have that in place, and you also get the benefit of that, right? So all fees that we get on the front end or back end then become part of our overall return.
Yeah, that's right.
Maybe quickly, I'll flip to page 13. You can get a sense for kind of our experience historically in terms of investment performance. On the far left column, that's the High Point Capital predecessor fund that I mentioned. We started in 2005. We had a gross IRR of 9.8%, a net IRR of 8.5%. And then most recently with Crescent, we had direct lending. We had an unlevered fund and a levered fund. The only difference is one uses debt to leverage your investments and get you a higher return. But they're investing in the same businesses other than one was raised a little bit sooner than the other. But as you can see, on the net side, on that, the levered fund, that's 9.6%, which, again, with any lift in LIBOR, that's the bottom right corner. With any lift in LIBOR, we should be within that 10% to 12% pretty easily.
Can you just mention a little bit on why Crescent bought you out?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, no, that's fine. So Crescent had been looking, so first of all, when we were started in 2005, we were backed by a few high net worth investors. We'd spun out of Fleet Bank, which was acquired by Bank of America, and they were moving all of our jobs to either New York or Charlotte. We were all based in Boston. So we decided we'd raise our own lending group called High Point Capital. We were backed by high net worth investors, including the Kraft family who owned the Patriots. We were able to, at that point in time, access a fair amount of leverage on our own balance sheet. This is pre-crisis. Fair amount of leverage on our own balance sheet to allow our high net worth investors to get equity-like returns for senior debt risk. I mean, to put it in perspective, we were delivering 30%+ IRRs to our investors on senior debt loans, just because you could lever the heck out of them. Through the recession, we had a great experience, had no payment defaults, but ultimately the world changed. The banks just didn't provide 10-to-1 leverage anymore. It was, back down to a more traditional leverage, which they'd always been at, which is what we're looking to do here, which is 1-to-1 leverage. And because of that, our high net worth investors basically said, look, you guys have done a great job, but this isn't a long-term part of our we'd like to sell the business to an institutional investor who has a appetite to build out a senior debt lending team and portfolio to get senior debt returns, which is what we're talking about here, right? And so ultimately that transaction was consummated in 2012, where we sold the business to Crescent. The entire team, which is really important, the entire investment team, the strategy came from High Point to Crescent. And we essentially, we always tell the market we change uniforms. So we're still doing the same exact thing we did at High Point, which was lower middle market lending to private equity owned businesses, just under a different team, a different strategy. A different company. The beautiful part about Crescent that we didn't have at High Point is that we have all these resources within the company. We have Pete, we have an IR team, we have a research team, such that we don't necessarily get an opportunity that comes in the healthcare space and we don't understand the reimbursement rate exposure of that particular healthcare opportunity, we can pick up the phone and call a healthcare analyst who knows all the competitors, can put us on the phone with the CEO of a public company and tell us everything we need to know about that sector. That we didn't have that at High Point. So this is real value
to working at a larger institution. As Pete mentioned, we've got 80 investment professionals. If I'm looking at a deal, and I know our mezzanine team, for example, has invested in the space, I'll call up the deal team and say, give me the background, what were the risks? And that's what we're constantly focused on. What are the risks? Where can we get hurt?
Is there a specific sector that you guys focus on more than another?
Good question. So the answer is no. I'll tell you, we don't invest in real estate. We don't invest in oil and gas. The reason why is because we can't box the risk. You know, we're senior debt lenders. We're really focused on kind of conservative, safe, kind of go to sleep at night, easy to understand businesses. So to give you some examples of businesses that we've lent to in the past, we invested in a gutter cleaning business. We've invested in a septic tank cleaning, a residential septic tank cleaning business. We invested in a commercial grease trap business at restaurants. These are all recurring businesses, recurring revenue businesses. They're very easy to understand. Look, I mean, this is a pension fund, a retirement fund. You know, we're conscious of that, right? So we're not investing your money in a high risk, high beta type of opportunity. Similarly, all of us, all the senior members within direct lending, have their own money in this fund as well. And so we kind of look at it the same way. This should be a safer place to park your capital, and that's why you're not getting 15%+ return. It's a lower beta. But the companies, again, we're investing in are very, very well diversified across a variety of industries. We're not taking customer concentration risk. We're looking at companies that typically aren't very cyclical at all. They've been around for a long period of time, easy to understand businesses. We run our downside cases, again, off of the 08-09 recession, but we're typically whacking our companies in the downside case 30-40% in some cases, just to see how bad you can really stress test it and still be able to survive. Because, you know, we saw some of that in the recession. So we know it can happen again. We don't know when, and thankfully our portfolio is performing very well, but we know it can happen. So we want to make sure that if and when it does, that our portfolio remains intact. Do you want to walk through the term sheet, Andy?
Yeah. So on slide 24, or actually go to 25, it's the letter from. So as John has talked about, we're raising, so we're fund one is now sort of in harvest mode, so we're now raising fund two. We had our first close in September of about $750 million. We're looking to raise roughly around $1 billion of equity commitments. The investment period is 4 years. So this is illiquid capital. It's a kind of lack of vehicle like private equity, not as long as private equity, but the investment period is 4 years. The term of the fund is 6 years with two optional 1 year extensions that potentially could happen if there's a loan that goes into the portfolio at the end of the 4 year period and it needs another year or so to come out at the end. The management fee is 75 basis points. We have a preferred return of 7 with the incentive fee of 10%. So what that means is anything that we raise or we return over 7%, we share in that fee. We get 10%, we get 90%, but that's only after you guys get your full 7% return.
Can I ask a technical question?
Yeah.
Because this question came up, just so we're understanding. Without going too far into the weeds, can you explain how that calculation is done? Since we're looking at a internal rate of return calculation here, and we kind of touched on this last meeting, as opposed to a compounded rate of return, which we're calculating for all our other investments. So given the nature of the internal rate of return, which takes into consideration all the cash flows in and out, we're going to have partial capital calls along the way. So we've got a constantly moving number. Can you explain simplistically how that incentive calculation kicks in and you know, how that works.
Sure. So, just to be clear, this is not done all along the way, right? So this is done at the end of the life of the fund, right? So it's not, there's two different, you know, common terms used in the market. One is a European waterfall, one's an American waterfall, but anyways, throw that up. I don't need to confuse you there. But the point is, at the end of our investment period, you will get all of your, by that time, you will have all of your money back. You'll get a 7% return on your investment, whatever your investment was. All the, we do factor in all the cash flows in and out over that period of time. You'll get a 7% return on your investment. And then if there's anything over and above the 7%, it'll be split up 90% to you, 10% to us.
There's another model where it's on a loan by loan basis, but we don't do that.
And this is a current income return vehicle, which means, you know, along the way, right, when we get an underlying coupon and interest payment, right, that we don't hold on to that, because it doesn't stay on our balance sheet. That gets returned back to you along the way, right? And so there's cash flow out when we make an investment, and then you're getting cash flow in. Now the nice part about that is that your investment, right, call it $2 million, right, and it never really reaches $2 million because it's offset by the underlying principal and interest payments of the borrowers, right? And so it's kind of a, you hear the term J-curve effect. You never, it doesn't start down here at $2 million and then get too much back. It goes down slowly and then it kind of comes back up because you're getting the coupon, the interest and principal of the underlying loans, which offset it. And then, you know, we talked about the liquidity a little bit in the market, and that's one of the basis for why we're able to get a higher return on our loans. You know, the reality is we're higher priced debt. So if the company's growing, you know, in a significant way, they do get us out eventually. And a lot of these companies also trade. They're selling it to other private equity firms or strategic buyers. So if you look at the average life of our loan, it's between 2 and 2.5 years, right? And so, you know, you might say it's not a liquid market, right? You can't, you know, buy and sell these loans on an open exchange, but, you know,
it's not 10 years.
I mean, this talks about 6 years of two optional 1 year extensions. You're out of your loans in 2 to 2.5 years, you know, typically.
And then just as we talked about earlier, the portfolio fees, again, the you know, prepayment fees and the upfront fees are all passed through to the investors, which is not, you know, I know there's some of our competitors out there that's not the case. So we think that we're an investor-friendly fund, right? I guess the point of that. And you know, within the fund, you'll see anywhere from 40 to 60 loans throughout the life of the fund. If there's any other questions.
How do you generate your leverage?
So we have a leverage. We have a leverage loan provider. Wells Fargo is a group that we've used historically. That essentially on every loan provides us, you know, basically a turn of leverage. So if we're making a $10 million loan, we'd call $5 million of equity capital and $5 million of debt capital from Wells Fargo to then invest in that company.
So your leverage runs about 50%?
Yeah, it's 1-to-1. And that's kind of industry standard. It's pretty conservative. Again, by way of background, you know, we have comfort, you know, levering businesses more. I mean, certainly we did it, you know, back pre-recession. And we did it successfully, but I think the overall market is more conservative today. So 1-to-1 is where we lever the businesses.
Go ahead, Craig.
Practically every page of this proposal has the word these loans are secured.
Yeah.
How do you go about doing that? Is it leaning against? Is it leaning against our stock, or what is it?
It's both. We have a lien on all the assets of the underlying company. So whether it's equipment,
If they own the facility, we've got a lien on the facility. If it's underlying kind of accounts receivable or inventory, we have liens on that as well. And then on the stock as well, we always say we've got a lien on all the assets, but also the stock. So if, look, if things go really bad, and we had to, as debt lender, take over the company and sell it or force a sale, we would have an ability to basically vote off the board and take equity ownership through the,
if you're first in line,
through the pledge of stock. And yes, we are absolutely first in line. So company gets sold in a troubled situation, we are the first guys to get paid.
Have you ever had this occur in the company?
We did. We in 2007, we had a company called iBuys. It was based in Charlotte, North Carolina. The company provided litigation support services, which means they did copying, scanning, and imaging for law firms. And typically, they made a lot of them. We underwrote it as in good times and in bad times, people will sue each other, which was true. But what we didn't factor in was the recession was so bad that people didn't have money to litigate. And so what they did was they settled out of court. And so you didn't have these big pops, right? So like a case where you're scanning and imaging and photocopying thousands and thousands of documents for plaintiff and defense, right? That didn't happen anymore because the case was like ended before it even started because they didn't have the money.
Did you recover your loan?
So we recovered our loan in that situation, but in that situation, we did have to take equity ownership of the company. We recovered 100% of our loan. Yeah, we covered 100% of our loan, positive IRR. But lesson learned there was that was the only deal that we did not have a true private equity sponsor. We had a fundless sponsor, and they ran out of money to invest in the business. And that's why we highly value, you know, I started at the beginning, we do sponsor-backed deals. The lesson learned there was we didn't have a sponsor that could continue to invest in the company as things went down. So this business wasn't broken, it just ran out of capital. And so essentially we became owner of that business and got all of our money back. So actually it's a good case study for us.
Generally speaking, what do you have to pay the Wells Fargo with this leverage thing?
So it's also a spread over LIBOR. It's anywhere between 150 and typically 175 basis points. I think we're on the low end now, but it's a spread over LIBOR, which is good because it matches, right? And so the leverage kind of matches. It's a floating rate, just like our floating rate, but it's obviously a lot less than what we're charging our underlying borrowers.
So with that business, did you build it back up or did you just sell a gas?
So what we did on that business was we saw an opportunity really for that business to actually make some money. And so we spent 2 years. I was very involved at the company for kind of 2 to 3 days a week for 2 years. We hired new management. We implemented new systems. They had 17 locations across the country. We shut down 4. It's just, you know, we're underperforming, and we sold the business through a hired investment banker and ran a process and sold the business. So you know, it was a good learning experience, and it's also I think a good case study because it shows, like, you know, if things do go wrong in a significant way, we have the ability to fix it and get our money back.
What is the queue right now? If we want to invest, how long? What is the queue for getting the money actually?
For the next close?
Yeah.
We're anticipating a second close at the end of November. And then we'll probably have another close after that, probably sometime mid to late January.
Okay, so you can ask for little bits of a time at a time until we get the full amount.
Well, the way it's, so that if you want to mention the facility, as far as, you know, we don't call capital on every deal. We use a facility to borrow money, so we're only calling capital maybe, you know, once a quarter.
Yeah.
So instead of doing every single deal, we use that facility to borrow the money to put the loan to work, and then we'll call capital, you know, I guess 4 times a year.
otherwise we'd drive you nuts, right? We have a facility to, this week's called subscription line. This is not the leverage facility. This is separate. This is, it literally is just, it's a capital call line, right? So rather than calling capital from you 3 or 4 or 5 or 8 times a quarter, we'll call it once. So we'll draw down the subscription line to the end of the quarter, and then we'll true up. So the year equity will come in, we'll pay down the subscription line down to zero, and then we'll start again for the next quarter.
Okay, so once we get the document signed, when do you expect that you'll make first capital call?
If you made it in by the end of November, there could be a capital call.
End of December. It's typically end of quarter. We can work with you there too in terms of time.
Yes.
Can you update us on where we are with the documents? Everything got delayed a little bit. I'm not sure if it's with the board's attorney.
Yeah.
Where it was, because the board had agreed, you know, we were moving forward with a $3 million commitment.
Okay.
And, you know, honestly, originally we were hoping to make the previous close. The
first close.
And I'm not sure where the docs got hung on.
I will, as soon as we leave here, I'll get with Kim, who's kind of our you know, doc guru, and find out where it is with that. I saw an email recently that we had going, so I'll find out from you exactly where the docs stand out with this. Okay. Our lawyers, your lawyers.
I know the board attorney came in and was looking for a side letter agreement.
Right.
Similar to the other clients that actually I have with you.
Yeah.
And
that's where my
I don't know if it's hung in his office or you know where.
We need
to
get it going. I'll get an answer back by the end of the day today, and we'll figure out where we're at.
Okay. Would you agree to be a fiduciary to the plan?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, Randy, and I think that was the gist of the
side letter. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Any other questions? All right.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. We're excited. We need to get those documents signed and get you on board and start making us some money.
Sounds good.
So we'll be ready to go.
Okay.
Yeah.
Have a good day.
So you want to get Austin these extra? Is that okay to leave?
Thank you very much.
Yeah, appreciate it. Yeah.
Watch that forward right there.
Yep. Thank you.
Yeah, we usually have another room, but there's another meeting in that room, so they shoved us up to this room.
So it was fine. Thank you very much.
Okay. Send some of that cold weather down.
Thank you, guys. Appreciate it. I'll back to you later.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
Keep the leaves, though.
Yeah.
The leaves. Thank you.
That was it.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot. Thanks. Thank you very much.
Appreciate you guys coming in.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, everybody. Good day.
Take care.
All right. Well, that was a much better education session than I could give.
That's good when you don't have 3 of them, you know, and you don't limit them to 20. I mean, usually we limit them to 20 minutes, and can't really. I know it's not concerned about the library. It never really.
Yeah, a lot of good questions. I think everybody covered the very important
things. How do we stand with our city attorney on this?
City attorney's fine. He's already read that they have other clients that use this firm, and that what they have done is they've looked at the contract. They said, we agree with the contract, but we want these additional comments in there. Number one being a fiduciary to the plan in the side letter. They're signing on that they are a fiduciary to the plan, and numerous other 175 because they're international or they're national. So Florida state law requires certain, you know, Florida state law says you can't, you know, 112 says you can't invest in Iran and Sudan, and you know there are different state laws that.
Well, this thing that they requested that we sign to initiate this. It's not a certificate of stock or anything like that. It's just an agreement that we agree to give them $3 million to perform these services.
Well, it's a, it's a collective group. Actually, we're investing into a form of collective fund or LLC.
Okay.
And so all the engagement documents with this registered investment manager, so we'd be buying into our pro rata share.
But it's not like buying a stock or anything like that.
No, it's not. It's definitely not. It's a private offering. Absolutely. It is not a publicly traded.
Have we done any checking out on what their rating is and all that kind of stuff?
We did that via your line of questioning.
Yeah.
And the most common way to get a quick and dirty answer is what is your
yeah.
I thought you hit the exactly on the target of that question.
They are obligated to pay us that amount, or is it split off all the fees, etc., so it would be less than 12% or whatever.
Obligated to pay
to pay us.
They're obligated 7.
Seven.
And then anything over the 7%, we keep 90% and they keep 10%. So 7% on the $3 million is $210,000.
Right. And again, nothing, there is no guarantee here. There's no obligation. We are an investor alongside other investors, institutional investors like this fund. And, you know, hopefully they're going to earn more than 7%. So the rate of return is, I don't want to say open-ended, because this is such a conservative and constrained methodology and approach that it's likely to fall within the ranges they discuss.
So it's strictly an income. There's no chance of growth of our fund or anything like that at all. But
chance of fraud?
Growth.
Growth.
Yeah, like a stock. There's no chance of growth at all.
No, this is strictly a lending.
You know, I look at what the market's done this year. What is it, 25% up since the first of the year, roughly?
Something like that.
Boy, index funds are just rolling in money. Unbelievable.
And we're heavily indexed. We only have one equity manager that's not index fund.
Yeah. I'm curious how we're doing with that, too.
Get to that. We'll go through the quarterly report.
Yeah.
Does anybody have any other questions on that?
I have some bad news. This meeting just nothing worked because I have a general meeting going on and a police meeting going on in the afternoon. Apparently Alicia sent the stuff to city clerk, and somewhere city clerk didn't pick it up. It's kind of everybody's doing this, but the meeting did not get posted. Therefore, we cannot take any action. We can go ahead. I mean, we listened to them. We didn't have to take any action on that. We've already taken the action. Dave's going to do the quarterly report, but as far as approving the minutes and approving the drop payments and all that stuff, we legally cannot take any action at this meeting. So I just wanted to, and I apologize for everybody for the short notice. This was the craziest meeting in 17, 18 years I've been on the board. I've never, just nothing was falling into place at all.
The fact that everybody showed up.
It's kind of incredible. You know, I was going through my emails last night because she always sends out stuff to the board and everything, and I was going through my emails and I'm like, we didn't get an electronic quarterly report, and I'm like, you know, what happened? I know she sent it out to the board and I couldn't find it anywhere, you know, and that's why I was grabbing my phone and texting, hey, meeting tomorrow, you know. So I apologize for the craziness, and but anyways, so we'll go through the quarterly report. And
so do we have to have a special meeting to approve that stuff?
We can have a special meeting, or we can just put it off till our next quarterly meeting.
There's not a whole lot on there.
There really isn't.
I know there's a long list on there, but
past, what would you learn more about that?
It's fine. As long as it's before they start the implementation, I'm okay. Any financial package that they're doing?
Yeah, and we can talk about all this stuff.
Yeah.
We can't, we just can't.
We can't approve it at this moment. It is what it is.
Let's just say we'll table it and we'll, you know, we'll, I'll talk to Felicia and we may schedule another meeting in December sometime. And just do a quick meeting to approve something.
That means we get paid for two meetings this quarter?
Yeah.
Okay. At the same rate?
We'll give you time and a half.
All right.
You get double what you normally get.
Well, the board last week had voted themselves a 10% raise.
But I do, because I know it's volunteer and this is taking your personal time, so that's why. As long as I've been on the board, I've tried to keep everything down to quarterly meetings because I know your time is valuable and I don't want to have you in here, you know, every month. So if we can squeeze all the work into the quarterly meetings, that's what I have preferred to do. But there's going to be a new sheriff in town soon, so we'll see what happens. Okay, Dave, if you want to...
All right. Thank you, Reese, for covering me on the support distribution. He's kind enough to print them all up this morning. I'm not sure what happened on my end. But before we go into the report, I also want to give you a quick firm update on AMCO. You know, I know I took everybody through the name change and everything, and we had previously discussed that we had an order of new directors, directorship positions, so those would be management positions over each of the vital areas of the firm. And I also communicated that we had, I don't want to say gifted, but we had three new what I call hard equity partners get earned out ownership. So they'll be filing K-1s and paying taxes in seven states. And at the same time, we basically eliminated or ripped up the original Bogdan agreement, partnership agreement, and reinstated, you know, appropriately a new AMCO agreement. So since that was done, I took the opportunity to monetize and basically cash out my ownership in the firm as one of the last, you know, remaining. Obviously, Joe's long gone as one of the last remaining partners. So I'm going to continue on as long as you will have me and as long as AMCO will have me with an open-end consulting agreement. And it's just great for me because I get to stay focused on you know, what I want to do, and that's work with clients like you and go through the investments. So I think it's a win-win for everybody. We're making room for the, you know, next generation to lead us on. But again, I can't retire yet, so, and I love this, I love what I do, so hopefully, you know, we can continue on uninterrupted under my new arrangement. And then we also officially anointed three new what I call phantom equity owners, and this is a share class that doesn't show up on the ballot. It doesn't show up on the ballot sheet, or it doesn't require a filing, and it's a profit sharing participation. And this anyone in a firm is eligible. You don't have to be an executive manager to be awarded this. In fact, one of the awards was given to one of the original Bogdan employees who's responsible for compiling a lot of our books since day one from Joe Bogdan. So well deserved ownership there. So I just want to let you know, there are changes. So when we file our ADB in January, that new ownership structure will show up there. So that's my update. So let's get into the bottom line. And we ended up with obviously an excellent year. And if you look at page two for our usual
executive summary here. I'll limit comments to the year. We had three really big events impact returns here, the first of which is obviously the optimism in the equity markets. And that was further pushed forward by the general acceptance that the Eurozone and, has kicked in, and we're now in a global recovery rather than just a U.S. recovery. And along the lines of that, we saw a continued thematic shift. We were talking about the active-passive performance problems. We actually did see a continuation of that thematic shift from investors investing on fundamental earnings. So for the second quarter in a row now, indexing has actually finished in the bottom quartile, and active managers have actually been able to show outperformance to the benchmarks. If it's just the inflection for the change of that active-passive cycle, you know, we won't know. But it is notable. So that takes a lot of pressure off with the active, you know, management community. Second thing is, I think everyone's aware, Fed has been increasing short-term rates pretty substantially, as was noted this morning. But actually, long-term rates came down. And those are the rates that matter, that drive the economy, 10-year treasury, 30-year treasury. And when rates go down, as you know, due to the bond math, your bond price goes up. So we actually retraced that negative total return we were showing in the investment grade bond fund this last quarter. So for the year, if you look at the Barclays, Barclays ended up flat or up 0.1%. So the best performers on the year were international equities, EAFE up 19.1, that's our developed country stock index. The MSCI emerging markets was the best performer, up 22.5. At home, the S&P 500 up 18.6. And small cap stocks were the best performers at home, up 20.7. And then if you go down to the Bloomberg or the BBG Barclays Corp IG, that's the corporate bond index. And noted earlier, credit has been very, very well bid. One of the things that, as a 30-plus year practitioner and asset allocation strategist working in different places, one of the best predictors of potential problems ahead is when the credit markets start to demand a little more money for what they're lending. And we track that by looking at what's the yield spread available above U.S. Treasuries. When that yield spread is big, that means investors are very worried about the underlying credits and creditworthiness of corporate America. When that yield spread is very small, that means there's not a worry out there, and they're willing to accept a little return. Now, I would argue that the high yield bond market, if there's a bubble anywhere, that's where it is. Not only is the rate being paid to high yield sub-investment grade investors below because interest rates are low, but that incremental spread is as tight or as small as it has ever been. So the good thing is that means bond investors are comfortable with the economy. No worries out there, to say. But the bad thing is that area is very, very, very fully valued. So when we go into the PIMCO Diversified Income Fund, one of the things we're paying that manager to do is to move in and out of those sectors that provide the most attractive opportunity. And they've actually already started to move out of the high yield and increase the quality of the portfolio. So from a macro standpoint, it speaks well. You know, we got good, solid fundamentals. The economy is looking pretty good. Underlying credit worthiness of corporate America looks good. But the negative side of that is, this was, credit was one of the best performing areas. That's one area. Everything was fully valued
going forward.
I would argue, if we had a dedicated high yield manager, that's the type of investment you want to be in. making money and then you want to be out. It's not a long-term investment. We didn't take that route here. We gave the high yield responsibility to a manager who's going to make that allocation decision for us through the PIMCO fund. And they are. They're moving that way. So those were the significant observations. The news is very good. So turn up to page 18. And if you follow with me on the top line there for the quarter, we closed the September fiscal year. I know we're all sitting on pins and needles, but we had a great quarter. So that put us at 12.8% for the fiscal year. Obviously, we handily retired the actuarial required rate of return objective number one, first and foremost met. The 3-year number now annualizes at 7.8%, and the 5-year number annualizes at 9.3%. Looking at that fiscal year number, happily we are ahead by just under a percent, or 0.97, to our passive policy benchmark. And that extra amount of return is attributable to the overweights and underweights that we've been working or trying to finesse in the asset allocation relative to the policy. Since our active manager element is, as you pointed out, is very minimal, most of that return differential came from how we've been trying to finesse the asset allocation. Peer group ranking in the public fund universe. Up in the 37th percentile, again, one being best, 100 being worst. The 3-year number, we're ranked in the top 11th percentile. So even though this has been a pretty conservatively managed fund, that's paid off, I think, relative to other systems. And the 5-year number annualizing at 9.3, we're in the top 21st percentile. So we could close the book there. It's great news, but let me just hit, let's give credit where credit's due.
Let me touch on that. The inception 7.16 number, that's since 1994. That's our long-term investment assumption rate is 7.50. We're at 7.16. That's very close. So we're doing well.
And that's weathering, I think they stated mildly, the recession.
That's including the 08-09. I mean, our shorter numbers look better, but, we're long-term investors, and that's 94, that's 25-ish year number, 7.16. We're very close to our long-term assumption.
Yes. So continuing down, Dalton is our all-cap value manager. We just finished our research, just finished doing a deep dive on these guys, and he just reiterated that continue with this manager, right? And they reiterated in the workup that, we recognize that during bull markets that this manager, we hope that the manager keeps up. And the real value behind this approach historically has been to capital preservation when equity markets roll over. Looking at the peer group returns and the index relative returns, they're a little bit behind the index, and the peer group returns they're going to be flagging, obviously, in our policy document. With the support of the research and having familiarity with the strategy, and given how long we are in the cycle, and given the loosely stating there's an inherent factor out there that active managers tend to provide the best performance in down markets. Now, 2008, 2009 was a bit of an exception because everything correlated to one. Now, will the next bear market, will that be another panic button? Because is everyone wants to get out ahead of it with all the index fund circulation of index funds out there. I don't know. But historically, active managers and this manager in particular were put on this portfolio because of their ability to preserve during down markets. You know, we don't know if the cycle ends tomorrow, 3 years from now, 5 years from now. You know, they are at least keeping up. So
what's Bob's best guess? What's your best guess
for downturn?
The downturn? I think we are overdue a 5 to 10% correction.
I agree.
What triggers it and when it happens?
Nobody knows.
I have no idea. But that being said, I think it's fair to make the case that it would be a correction in it within an ongoing bull market. So we'll never time it, we'll never get it, but the underlying fundamentals for the global economy, and as I was talking about earlier, the credit fundamentals are very, have been very good.
Who do you think is going to take the biggest hit of the downturn?
There's been a lot of rotation, so there's not any one sector other than the FANG stocks still being pretty fully valued. The Amazon, Facebook,
FANG stocks are just terrible.
Hugely valued. And usually it would be the leadership, right? That gets hit. And that group is still very fully valued, and that would be, obviously those are, you know, pretty large cap stocks. And I, you know, if there was a correction, it would, you know, one might argue that it would be because of concerns over growth faltering. So then the other thing that's been going on here is it looks like the baton has been passed from value stocks to growth stocks. So it would suggest that growth stocks.
Well, see, it's the funny things happening right now, like GE today cut their dividend rate in half. First time since the recession. In their stock.
Yeah, that would be the time to buy GE.
What's that?
That might be the time to buy GE.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, there's a laundry list of items that could trigger it. Could be nuclear, could be failure to pass the tax proposal. But the underlying, I mean, Trump, as much as he would like to claim responsibility, has had absolutely nothing to do with this market run-up and the health of the economy. It's like every president, and in the right place at the right time. All of, you know, sure does. And the underlying fundamentals have just been very, very good. It hasn't been the fastest recovery, but there's nothing wrong with slow.
And that's my whole thing. You know, everybody complains, oh, it's the slowest recovery ever after a recession. Hey, I'll take slow and steady over volatile and
more sustainable.
You know.
Yeah. So that's my best guess to your question.
I pray the Lord we had all these index funds.
It's been a good decision that by the board. They haven't suffered like others. I do have some systems that had blue cap, because I try to keep a balance between active and passive. And the first place to exit, obviously, has been in large cap growth, right? So that's historically been the toughest place to favor. I do have some clients that are contrarian in nature, and we're liquidating our index fund after being completely unscathed with this active passive debate, and we're going into select active managers right now, hoping to catch the change in the cycle. But these are, you know, this is a board that's interested in going contrarian, and you know, we're still in the market. We're not market timing. But you know, as you know, here I like to, where possible, present counter trends and, you know, some counterintuitive ideas. And, you know, so I do have a handful of clients moving into active, for lack of a better term, we'll call it taking a flyer with active right now. Again, because it is late in the cycle. And looking for downside protection and just completely going counter cycle to where all the money, to your point, where all the money is flowing in and that's there. But if you look at, all right, so did I address your question? All right, so quickly, the large cap value index fund value stocks gave us 14.8% growth stocks. Big performers, and that's because of the performance of late, up 21.79. Small cap stocks up 6.25. That was all index. And then looking to the next page, the international fund. I think we should be actively managed here, and we are with American Euro Pacific Fund. They completely closed up that underperformance gap. So for the year, they ended up over the benchmark by about 0.5% and ended up in the top 7th percentile. On the bond front, the domestic fixed income, we're looking at the inflation protection securities, and again, this is one of those cyclical things. You know, we've been way underweight our policy target, and with rebalancings going forward, we're slowly going to bring that back up to the 5% target. But TIPS, obviously, when rates went up, TIPS suffered. So for the year, they were down 1%. On the bond portfolio, Integrity, actively managed for the year, almost 1% of incremental return. So that was worthwhile.
Bad quarter, but over the long, over the year, it was good.
Right. And in our global bond portfolio, of course, we eliminated the Templeton Global Bond Fund. And, you know, you never know without the benefit of the glasses. But we took out over a 16% rate of return for, you know, a very short period in a bond fund. And most of that, as you guys know, was currency driven. Well, I think last time we met here, the dollar euro was about $1.04. Yeah. And the dollar has since retraced all the way back to about $1.17, $1.18. And this is a counter move to how that fund was positioned. Now, I'm sure the portfolio manager made some adjustments as well, you know, but we were able to get out of a fund that was giving us more volatility than, you know, we were comfortable with, and we got out, you know, the timing ended up coincidentally working pretty well. PIMCO Diversified Income Fund, I referenced earlier, doubled to the benchmark of 7% versus their benchmark of 3%. And then on page 20, rounding out the portfolio with the real estate managers, the American Core Realty for the year was up 7.5. The UBS Realty was up 5.3. And the Intercontinental Real Estate, our more aggressive manager in the mix, we've relatively recently funded, up just under 12%. So you have the two most conservative real estate managers. So we're positioned for the slowdown whenever it comes, right? And the real estate returns that American Core is showing now are, I think, are more realistic going forward. We're looking for 7-ish% long-term rate of return coming out of real estate. UBS, the major market trophy properties in Manhattan and LA, those properties have definitely peaked out in appreciation. You know, that's the most conservative property type investment. So those returns come down significantly. And Intercontinental, again, with its more middle, small, mid-market size deals in the peripheral, is still grinding out you know, some good returns, but that's a much higher leverage.
It's like a covenant over Europe. I was over there twice this year, and I was stunned at their unemployment ratio. France and Italy are 12%. With kids age 16 to 25, is 43%. One thing I can't understand, and I didn't know this, is all of these immigrants that are escaping from Africa and Syria, they won't let them work. They can't get a job because they're afraid they'll take the jobs of the people that live there. So the euro pays them $1,200 or 1,200 euros a month, but they can't get a job. It's hard to say I've ever heard of. But their economy is really something. To give an example, in Paris, a pair of men's shoes is 375 euros. A leather jacket is 1,000 euros. There are people that are flying to the States just to buy clothing, believe it or not, which is really wild. But I'm a little concerned about their economies over there. That unemployment rate is out of sight. That's four times, or three times in our sense.
Yeah, I think it's Spain, the number of ratios. I
think most of your growth is in Germany and Northern Europe, because Southern Europe, Italy, Spain.
Yeah, the Baltics are all fine.
Greece are all always historically bad performers and bad oversight and everything, and your big performers are.
Unfortunately, the Baltic states, no one lives there. We got 21 million people in Florida, they got 26 million, all the countries in the world. That's all the people.
Yeah, but you still got Sweden and Finland and Denmark is going
to control the banking for the whole world, don't they?
They've got
they own the Fed too.
But I'm a little concerned about long-term investment in Europe.
So any questions on the percentage of returns? Again, good year, and just a quick look at the asset allocation. I know we can't do anything, but I don't have any recommendations either on page 12. I guess unofficially, for purposes of this meeting, I don't have any allocation recommendations for the board to act on. My suggestion is to continue to ride the momentum we have here. We're appropriately overweight domestic equity. I think going forward, for any rebalancings, it would be beneficial to overweight international equity and bring our domestic equity down closer to benchmark. I think the underweight we have to domestic fixed income is still appropriate. And the real estate overweight, I think, and I think we talked about this last meeting, is something I think we need to put out on the radar screen for potential rebalancing. So if interest rates, interest rates go up, and those yields start to equalize, then I think we want to start looking at
the interest rates are going up. I said, yeah, I've been hearing that for about 10 years.
Yeah, so,
and they can't go down, so.
Yeah, the only other administrative update really is what we covered this morning with Preston, and we'll keep the press on to get those documents done. He promised me, he's going to email me today with an update on what's going on with our office. I'm not sure where that goes.
Where's the thing that says how much cash we're keeping?
Yeah, you can get the cash on the bottom line there.
Million. We're almost at 60.
The direction of the center. Yeah, because we already established that would be coming out of the
I didn't know if we wanted to
primarily bonds, but if we need to rebalance, some of it may come out of equity.
Okay.
This is also allocation, so I'll send you a...
Where is the cash?
Okay. If you look at the receipts and disbursement line item on 16, and take it all the way over the right, so you can get cash, doesn't it, from September 30th, that way. And obviously, we're keeping a minimum balance.
Caps.
They pay for it.
So in 07,
57, they're using that money for something, and surely are worth a lot more than that.
Well, yeah, the labor rates up.
Yeah, I understand that.
Yeah, the money market should be paying out about 0.5% now.
Wonderful.
Yeah, so as Ed pointed out on page 16, you know, plant assets stand at 67.7 million. And, you know, we're at about $2 million, some stuff that get us up to that number.
Keep in mind, in 2008, we were at 19 million.
And from a cash flow standpoint, you know, we're about even until the chairman retires, then we'll go upside down in cash flow. But we're about even money.
We can't be too excited because it is, like you said, there's a correction. It's not a matter of it's a matter of when.
Yeah.
And it, you know, who knows what's going to trigger it, like you said.
Well, it's coming. We'll be ready.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean.
Well, I mean, you look at our long-term number, 7.16. Yeah. We're close to our assumption.
Yeah,
you know,
we're always, so, you know, we're looking at the horizon, and we're, you know, I mean, it's going to happen, but, you know.
What's the assumption?
7.5.
And then Alicia will have everything to the actuary, so hopefully they'll have a our actuarial report by our February meeting. And I think what I'll do is, you know, when I get in the next week or so, I'm going to a conference down in Orlando tomorrow, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. There's a conference, a state conference.
Can I go over there? Or?
I don't think so. I think I'm the only one.
I'm not going. Take good notes.
Huh?
Take good notes.
Yeah, I will. This is the one put on by the state. It's specifically for police and fire pension.
What is the one down in Lauderdale? What's the date over there?
The next step.
Yeah, the West Coast one every year.
Come on down.
They have it.
Oh, it's got it. Okay.
That's the day.
That's
in January
today. Oh, it is?
No, it's the Klausner account. Klausner's not having a conference
this year.
Oh.
He sent us a notice stating that due to the hurricane and all of the plans that have been affected and the members that have been affected and the fact that Pier 66 received some damage, that they're calling off the client conference this year, and they're going to do a virtual conference so we can go in our computers and get educated that way. But they're not going to have an actual conference this year.
That's a shame. I don't really enjoy it.
When is the Tallahassee meeting?
The Tallahassee is in April, May.
It's in the spring.
Yeah, it's in the spring.
Yeah, it should be, I don't have the dates for that one yet, but it should be in May.
That's the one I would go to.
Can you let me know?
Yes.
I'd like to go to the Tallahassee.
Yeah. I will bring information in February.
Okay, good. Yeah, the next step, PTA, is also at the Hyatt Regency in Atlanta, and that is
January.
29th, 30th, the end is last day of January.
28th to 31st.
The Tallahassee School it was late last year. It was May 31st through June 2nd, but usually it's not that late. But that's what it was last year. And that is a good school. That's a very good school. Okay, I think we'll probably, if you guys, are you okay with another meeting sometime in December? I'll get with you guys and get with some dates and we'll just do Dave doesn't have to come really to that meeting. We'll just do kind of the housekeeping, pass some of this stuff.
This is just the meeting dates for next year for you guys. I need to make another copy for you, Randy.
No, I'll need a copy.
Why don't you go ahead and set the date?
Do you want to do that now? Or should I just have a calendar? Or?
Can we set it for the next meeting?
Yeah.
Can we do this?
Sure. Yeah.
December?
What day of the week are we talking?
Next week is Thanksgiving, so I think it would be best.
Week of the 4th?
I will be out of town the 4th. Through the 8th. So 11, 12, 18, 19, 11, 12. That's kind of middle. It's plenty before Christmas. So the week 11, 12, 13, 14, 15. Anybody?
I'm pretty shocked that week.
Not Friday.
That week.
Okay. Is Monday's best for you, Justin? Or?
Mm-hmm. What is Friday?
No, it's going to be a real quick meeting. So let's say Monday the
11th. I probably won't.
Do 9 o'clock?
You can't do it.
Okay. We're not doing that, or?
What about the 12th, Tuesday?
That week I'm pretty much shot.
Okay. I'm shot the week before. You're shot that week.
What day are we doing?
The next week, Tuesday on Monday. I'm doing hydraulics and apparatus next week, and with Eric's retirement, I've got to be there a lot, at least the first day or two of the class.
Okay.
Are we getting 27th out?
What about a week from today, the 20th?
I will not be here a week from today.
Okay.
Yeah. Monday the 27th. Or the
that's
week of the 27th.
Well,
it's the week after Thanksgiving.
No.
That's the week after.
Yeah, that's the week after. Yeah. Or is that too close for notice? How long do we need to do it?
Wait. 5 days.
Okay.
27, okay with you? No.
We're in January now.
Well, December 9th should be a good day for everybody because nobody's college football team should be playing then.
So you're at home. How about the 25th, Monday?
I'm working, I'm good. I'm on duty, I can make it.
No, I'm just kidding.
Of December?
Yeah.
I'll call in.
Yeah.
Do we get holiday pay?
Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Get really paid for that one. Probably aren't going to get everybody here.
That's why we have 5 board members. It's for me. It's day one of hydraulics, and I am now the only hydraulics instructor at the college, so I have to be there Monday. Giving me helpers. I just have to be there Monday morning.
Like I said, it's going to be a 20-minute meeting anyway. Yeah. We're just going to approve the drop payments and some other stuff. So.
Monday the 11th.
I'll mail you an absentee ballot.
Okay. Monday 11th. Alicia, can you check and see if the room is?
If it's not, we'll be here.
Okay. We'll just make it Monday 11th, 9 o'clock.
Dude, it's a half hour in front. You guys just meet the day, Sean.
What's that?
So you guys just need the bagel shop, if it's 30 minutes, two of us can't make it.
Yeah, and I'm sorry, there were so many crazy things that happened, I apologize that we have to do that, but it happened. And I'm going to be gone, I'll only have two more meetings maybe, so we need to think about who wants to take over as chairman and all of these things, and we need to get some signature issues change. So this is something we all need to think about as a board. Does anyone else have anything? Okay, with no further business for the board, the meeting an official meeting.
The information exchange.
Yeah, informational meeting.
The pension board information exchange.
The meeting of adjourn.
You know, you don't have to retire once you retire from this job. We could just kick you off.
No, you can't.
You